Hello, and welcome to Muse and Metrics. This is your host, Philippa Burgess. This is Season 5, Episode 4, and today's topic is Advocate for Equity.
I'm Daisy Mayorga. I am a Women Tech Maker Ambassador and new co-founder of Yuda. It's a company that empowers equity in emerging technologies, so we work to try to educate and advocate for underserved communities to learn and leverage emerging technologies. And I'm also a mother and a project manager. I wear many hats and I'm really excited to be on the podcast today.
I love it. That's great. And so just to give some context, and this is not lived experience, this is more learned experience. I have a master's in urban planning and I don't think I really understood, and I probably still don't, the equity issues. And to be honest, like my understanding is just the tip. Like I need to hear it more and be exposed to it more. And I think other people do too, about what's really happening and what's really needed.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. There's so much work that is still needed coming from an underserved community and really trying hard to advocate for myself. I learned that I didn't do a really good job at it early on. I think I can't speak for everyone, but I can speak for myself. I try to stay very humble, and sometimes that's not helpful when you're looking for a job or when you're trying to get into a program. That humbleness and that culture that like we're kind of grew up in is like, stay humble, you know, like you don't have to share everything. And sometimes like when you're applying for that job, you can't stay humble. You need to share all your accomplishments. And culturally, like when you're not aware of that, you write a resume based on what you've done and not what you've accomplished. So there's a lot in just growing up in a different culture that really changes like the way you advocate for yourself.
I can see that. And it's also, there's the cultural aspect and there's the woman aspect.
Right.
Because how much of this is a female issue? Because you're also a mom, you're also juggling a lot of other things that we as women have to incorporate into how we think and the jobs that we can take and the commitments we can make, because we are expected to do a lot more in the home than even a man would be expected to do.
Right. Yeah. So I think that's pretty obvious, and not, you know, like in the workplace, at home, you hear things all the time when a father is involved. It's like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. When it's something women just do all the time naturally and don't get any praise for it. Definitely going to conferences all the time and going to events and hearing things as a woman, like, oh, who's your child with? Or who's taking care of them? It's like, well, why are those questions even need to be like asked, you know? And like, I don't know, like that is a big reminder of like the gender inequalities that are happening and still happening today. You know, it's kind of crazy, but that stuff is still really happening. So you have all this guilt of like being a mother and like being away from your child, and definitely in the workplace, you're always kind of pushed more towards the client side because you're friendly and you can talk to people. And as a developer, like I experienced that, and it's frustrating a little bit because you study, like, so I studied computer science, but was pushed more towards the, you know, like business facing side, client facing side. And it's like, this is not what I signed up for. You know, I want to develop. And that happens all the time. And I hear the stories, you know, as a Women Tech Maker Ambassador, you get to talk to a ton of women who experience the same thing. And you think, I honestly thought going in, it's like, it can't be that bad. And it is. So I agree. And I see that there's definitely a gender gap. And there's also, like you mentioned, a cultural gap as well.
So there's even an immigrant mindset that is a little bit different than people who don't have that there's an expectation as an immigrant. Like, we brought you here. Go make something of yourself. Go do something. So there's a humbleness, but there also is a push, I believe, that comes with, you know, we worked really hard to get here.
Yeah, I think we can get into so many different complexities of all the different gaps there are, right? As an immigrant, if you're a DACA recipient, how many barriers you have to go through and how much like DACA recipients actually invest in the economy, yet don't get the same in return, right? Like, these are people who were brought here at a young age and, you know, like, weren't afforded the same opportunities and are doing so much great things in the United States. You know, there's that hustle you're talking about. Like, you hustle, and you never stop hustling, but yet you will never get as far as someone whose family has been here for generations, because you may not have the connections. It just takes so much more work. And that's that hustle you're talking about, is like, you don't have those connections built. So I think programs like Women Tech Maker are really what will help bridge that gap between like you and opportunities. And now bringing Women Tech Maker ambassadors to all communities, like anywhere, really gives you like this network of, you know, amazing people that you can connect with, learn from, and then grow without having to have generational, wealth or generational networks here. So I think these programs are definitely needed. Ambassadors like you and me and so many others are needed in the community.
So we've talked about these barriers, but you've overcome so many of them. And let's talk about the exciting work that you are doing. You obviously a business owner, you're an expert in tech, you're a developer, but I also want to talk about some of the community building activities that you're doing. So let's start with GDG Modesto.
Yeah. No, GDG Modesto has actually been around for quite a while. So it was started by Jim Hudson, who's currently a mentor for the Pacific region. And then in 2019, I joined as an organizer, and shortly after became a Women Tech Maker ambassador. But yeah, we've been growing the community locally, and we started with like probably just a few handful of people coming to our events, to now our larger events being upwards of 200 people, and we're targeting 400 people for our DevFest this year.
That's amazing. So you're now impacting hundreds of people, which very quickly adds up to thousands of people,
right?
As that sort of reaches, and to make tech more accessible. What are some of the gaps that you're seeing where people in your community need the most help?
I think it starts first with advocacy, which we've talked, you know, a lot about. Being able to say like, hey, I belong here. And that's like the first barrier to get over, right? And we all experience that, like, do I belong here? How you were saying that, you know, like, you were talking to an expert, yet you had done so much work and research and all that just to say like, I want to get into the space. But, you know, like, that advocacy for yourself is important. And so we are trying to build a safe community where people feel comfortable asking questions. They feel comfortable sharing their knowledge. And so that's the first barrier we've kind of helped to overcome. And then here locally, there's not a lot of opportunity in tech. So we're trying to work with local businesses to see what they're actually using for technology, and then bringing them into our community and sharing, you know, opportunities that they have available, because there's a lot of every company has a tech department or some kind of tech role. And we're trying to hear from local businesses and say like, hey, share that with the community, because they're not aware of this. So that there's opportunities is another one that we're working on. And then the education, the emerging technology education, is definitely not here in our local community. So bringing events like DevFest, Day-to-Day, where we talked about data analytics and data science, those events are not happening here. So we're definitely trying to bring them in. So access to the actual technology is another barrier. So those are pretty much like things that we've been working on. Yeah.
That's amazing. And a lot of work, I'm sure. No doubt. A lot of work goes into that. And what do you feel is the response? I mean, obviously more and more people are coming to these events and are participating. Are you, when you're marketing and doing your outreach, do you feel that it's landing and people are saying, oh, I'm excited that this is here? Or is there still kind of, I don't really know what that is and would I even belong there?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a mix of both. Right? It takes a little longer for some people to feel like they belong than others. I think we've done a really good job at both marketing and trying to create a safe community, trying to bring in and showcase different people and different skill sets. So that, I think, is what is an advantage for us, is we are highlighting a lot of people in the community that are doing great things. And when you have representation from different individuals, like, you get more response. You get, you know, like, we see that, you know, with so many things just in society and how much representation actually does matter. And that's what we're trying to build, is just like having different representation. If you look at our organizers, we have quite a few organizers in our community because we want to have different skill sets and different voices that we want people to learn and hear from.
So having those people available and making themselves visible within the community so that there's children out there who can say, oh, wow, that's someone who I can have as a role model. That's something that I can see and that's possible. And they represent something in life that I want, or I want to express, or a value that I want to create. We never know what we're creating just by being in the world, being who we are, and shining as brightly as we do. I mean, being an author, let's talk, you have a book, and you know, there's other people who will see that you have a book and say, oh, you mean I can write a book? Because some of these things, especially when I think, well, tech also falls into some of that entertainment media where people separate it from their normal lives and what's possible. And they don't necessarily see that as that's an approachable, realistic thing that can be done if you move yourself through a process and you have a belief, a plan, and commit some resources, and you can come out the other side and have a book. So tell us about that process of writing and what inspired you to write, and tell us about your book.
Yeah. So I have my first children's book about Web3 and the journey, like, from Web1 to Web3. It's a really simple read, and I've been talking with a few of the ambassadors about creating a children's book for a long time now, and I have a little extra time now. So I was like, I'm going to do this, and spent some time on it. Probably the longest thing was like creating the graphics. But it was exciting, and I want everyone to have access to emerging technology and education at any level. And I'm going to translate the book to Spanish to have even more access for kids to, you know, learn about emerging technology. When I was going to school for computer science, I didn't see a lot of people that looked like me. And it definitely was hard to be in a space like that. And I started reading about the statistics of, you know, women in computer science and technology, and you know, like, the diversity within the tech industry is really bad. I guess you could say that. And I thought to myself, like, well, how can I change that? This was before I even started Women Tech Makers, and I started thinking about it, and sometimes we want to make a big impact, or I guess, like, impact a lot of people. And I thought about it, and I was like, well, maybe I could teach my nephews and nieces, like, how to create their first website. And so that's what I did. Like, I made a goal of, like, I'm going to teach them, like, how to make their first website. And so I hosted, like, a little class for, it was like six of my nieces and nephews, and taught them about computer science, and they were able to build their first website with HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. We used Khan Academy, and then we used Replit, like, for them to actually host their websites online, so they were able to see at the end of this little course like their product. So that was pretty amazing. And I created community because I created a chat, a Google chat, and they, you know, they were on there chatting about like games and other things. And so I got to see that, and I was like, you know what, like I did, it was so rewarding to see that I knew that at least they were going to know about computer science, and they were exposed to that at an early age. So that was important to me. And it, I feel like I just want people to know, like, you don't have to like everything like you do, even if it's small, like that impact that you're making can change someone's life.
Very, very much so. I think that the detail and the just showing up and the doing the small things, but, and as you do them with consistency, yeah, as they grow, then they're going to have even more of an impact. But that's exciting. And I'm sure that will stay with all of them, mm-hmm, and will plant seeds that will then grow. Because I feel another thing just in the American culture that I see, because a lot of the people that I've interviewed are from South Asia, mm-hmm, and they have a very strong math and science in their culture. And with an entertainment and media background, I was just even looking at how we communicate math and science through our media. And we make fun of people who know math and science. It's not celebrated. That's part of it. It reflects our culture, but it also furthers that idea that you're a nerd or you're a geek or you're not, you know, it's not as socially acceptable in America to be really good at math. Mm-hmm. If you're really good at math, you're the outcast. And we're in India, if you're not good at math, you're the outcast. And so we also need to be aware of how we send these messages to our children, that you can be a math hero and be popular, yeah, and have friends. And that this is, and so we send these messages to kids right now that aren't actually preparing us for this very AI ML future, Web 3, Web 4, Web 5 future, yeah, that is here and going to be continuing to come at us. And that math and science are foundation to technology and this tech future. And so I think that we also just need to be aware of the conversation and the messages that we send to kids, and that they can have really positive math, science, computer science experiences that make them feel good and make them feel connected and make them feel that they belong.
Yeah.
I think what you did is extraordinary. And it is those feelings that they left with that are going to add to a better experience in their next science class, a better experience in their next math class.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. It was definitely rewarding to see them like enjoy it and say like, oh, that's why I need to learn about graphs, because I need to know where to place like this object, you know? So it was really cool to see how much they enjoyed it. And hopefully it does leave a lasting impact.
I love that. I think that's so great. And so you got your book, and that's great. Now, can you just explain for the adult who doesn't know the difference between Web 1, Web 2, Web 3? Because we have audiences who are into tech and follow tech, mm-hmm, and we have audiences who are, all of this tech conversation is new. They're very much into supporting women and women empowerment. And so let's just kind of do a primer for those who may be new to what Web 3 is.
Okay. Yeah. So if you think about medicine and how medicine has evolved over time, you want it to evolve and you want it to get better, and you want, you know, technology in medicine to get better. You can sort of think of that in the same way as you do the internet. You want the user to have a better experience. You want the internet to be safer for children. You want record keeping to be better. And a lot of those things are what Web3 is trying to do, is trying to make the internet better for the user, allowing the user to have access to their data and not have companies be the one to own their data. But now bringing that to the user and saying, like, you are going to own your own data, and you're going to be able to give that data to whoever you choose, you know, so kind of giving that power back to the user and the individual, rather than having big entities own a lot of this data that's out there. And a lot of that technology is, you know, can seem scary, like blockchain, you know, so like, just think of it like as the evolving internet, right? Like there's iterations that we go through, and we're at a time where in the internet, where we're trying to decentralize, give power back to the people. And I think, I don't know if that's a good primer, but I would hope that the goal is for people to start looking and reading into it and following people on TikTok that talk about Web3, and just learning like how that power is going to come back to the people.
And isn't there also levels of interactivity? I feel like the difference between Web 1 and Web 2 is sort of the rise of social media communities and the way that people could like interact with each other in ways that they couldn't before. Like Web 1 seemed to be like you could search and you could pop up a website. And then Web 2 sort of seemed like it had that connectivity. And now it seems like Web 3, I love that you're talking about the decentralization of it and taking that power back. But there's also some additional kind of ways in which we can use the internet and create and build upon it in ways that didn't really exist in Web 2. There's kind of these new iterations of what technology is enabling. And I guess that's also coming into the metaverse as well, and that where Facebook decided, hey, we're going to rename our company Meta because this is kind of the new direction that we're really taking it. It's no longer this just sort of one singular social media brand. It's this whole world that we're creating. I think Square, mm-hmm. which is the credit card processing company, they changed their name to Block in representation of blockchain. And so these companies are saying, no, there's these bigger kind of technology universes that we want to be representing. I knew Google was big. I knew Google had a lot going on. I don't think I really understood how much Google has going on until I became a Women Tech Maker ambassador. And I'm in producing content and doing kind of beta testing with some of the things that they give us early access to, and coming off of doing a Google I/O extended audio summit. And that audio summit gave me the opportunity, though I didn't attend the event, to spend hours listening to the keynote and several of the sessions to find that I was kind of blown away by how many things in our lives they touch and what they're developing and where they're going next. Because I think many people think, oh, Google, isn't that search? Isn't that email? And it's everywhere. I was just buying my mom a new TV and it's like Google TV. And of course, they own YouTube, so it's massive. And then I'm studying geospatial, so my area of study is in the spatial data science. And so realizing how much Google also is in spatial with Google Earth and Google Maps and Google Earth Engine, and now they have this new immersive experience where you can do a deep dive and sort of see what that bike path is going to look like. And so there's just a number of opportunities to see kind of within these companies, kind of they're representing these changes that are happening. Now, that said, though, given these behemoths and how much power they own and control, how much are they actually giving back to the people? And how well are we doing with this decentralization?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I don't think I have the answer to that. But yeah, that's a good one. I think that they're obviously like investing with like, I think it's a, they have, I can't remember what it's called, but they are working on releasing technology for startups that like Web3 startups. And I can't think of the name of the program right now, but I know that that's happening right for Google. And then like the Ethereum Foundation is also trying to help startups. So there's definitely help. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was saying, I'll give you one example that I saw was that all of this AI technology that they're creating, mm-hmm. that when they're speaking to developers at Google I/O Connect, they're like, this is for you. Build it. Build mm-hmm. on top of this. Go make your own apps. Go make your own products. And obviously use us as the foundation, but please run with this. No. We're not selling this to you to say, okay, end consumer, we've created it, you consume it. Mm-hmm. They're selling it to say, you know, we've put together these building blocks, go build something amazing.
Yeah.
And that was really exciting to me to sort of say, okay, with all these new tech skills that I'm getting and this community that I'm building, who knows what we can build with what they release with Palm 2, with Gemini, with other things. So that to me is power back to the people, because it didn't seem like there was a barrier to entry except for knowledge, skills, experience, and community. Sure, right. Are sizable asks, but if you are committed to building your skill set, building that community, and obviously totally understood, not even possible if not for people like you and communities, you know, where you're lifting people up and saying, you know, you can have an opportunity to do this as well. And so I think that that's a big part of this, is also making those opportunities more equitable and more mm-hmm. accessible.
Yeah.
But I was still pretty impressed and excited by what is being released and what can be built upon.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's always opportunities for companies like this to make things more accessible and equitable. Yeah. I think there's a ton of companies saying like, hey, here's our technology, build on top of it. Like that's a lot of what Web3 is, right? Like there's all these blockchain companies that want people to build on their technology. But I admire, I guess, companies like ICP who are working hard to create community in different areas and trying to make it equitable from the very beginning. That's, I think, like the true, like if you want to decentralize, bring in a big pool of diversity and then have diverse people build on your platform or on your technology. And I think you'll be really like, that'll change things, right? Like you're going to see things from a different lens. And part of what ICP is doing is building community first. And then from there, and a lot of people do this, like Google's doing this with Women Tech Makers and Google developer groups. You have to care. You have to want to help, right? And sometimes you get too caught up in like, we want to be big and big and bigger. And that equity lens gets lost. So I think that, yes, there's definitely companies trying to decentralize Web3, but it takes a lot of work to truly, truly make an impact in underserved communities. Because I can tell you right now, there is no big companies investing in Modesto to try to bring in Web3.
And investment is a huge, huge part of it. I think that there's a perception, again, because I lived in this very siloed, bubbled universe where it's like, well, if people are poor, that's on them. That's not, you know, we don't have anything to do with, you know, they can lift themselves up. But if you really look at where corporate dollars are spent, where government dollars are spent, studying urban planning, you realize how much of our worlds are manufactured and how much of our worlds are created experiences. And they're created positively and they're created negatively. Mm-hmm. And that's a created experience. And if we wanted to create something else, it's not hard, but it requires attention and dollars.
Yeah.
And a lot of those communities, you know, and that's actually one of the reasons why I kept going in tech, is because at the end of my urban planning degree, I was like, well, what do I do with this? And I started leaning into a lot of real estate development, real estate conversations and communities. And I was so taken aback and really felt like, wow, this is not my community. This is not aligning with my values. This is not the place for me, because it was so, the conversations were so financially driven. Like, well, do we make money here? And how much money can we make and how quickly can we make it? And it didn't matter what the environmental expense was, what the social expense was. And there was no interest in saying, you know, if we all get together and invest in this community, we can raise this community up. The only way they were interested in doing that is to outprice the people who were living there so they could move along. Mm-hmm. And that was like, no. This is where these people live. This is their community. And we're getting this issue a lot. For example, like Denver is trying to, from an urban planning perspective, saying, oh, we've got all these underserved communities, we've got disconnected sidewalks, there's places that just don't have enough tree cover, and that trees are a big part of equity. Because if you don't have trees, you don't have protection from shade, they provide more oxygen. Trees are a really great tool that an urban planner has to improve a community. But the problem is these communities are so distrustful of government mm-hmm. because they have been traumatized by them for decades that when the city comes in to put trees, all they think about is like, oh, great, we're now going to be outpriced from our communities. Mm-hmm. And because they're renters, not owners, that's a real fear of theirs that, wait, this has been our home. This is our community. These relationships that we have are a fabric. And when you rip that fabric, you lose childcare. You lose just people who you know, trust, and keep you safe. And so I think that we have to find ways that we can improve communities without tearing apart communities.
Yeah.
Because of that financial monetary incentive. And similarly, property owners who rent their properties tend to not add trees to those properties. So your well tree covered communities are the ones who have resident owners versus resident renters. And those are some of those, you know, societal inequities that we get. And I don't think people think about that's trees. Mm-hmm. And if you look 80 years later at the New York City map of redlining, where they say good community, bad community, all of those redline communities that exist today, if you overlay, because I did this project in school, a New York City redlining map from the 1930s over today, every place that they said is green good has tons of parks and open space. Every place that they said this is red bad, no open space, no parks. And so our built environment is such a reflection of equity.
Definitely. Yeah. I didn't think of trees that way, but you know, like when you do community scans, you definitely see what divides one side of town from the other, and how access is divided. When, like you're saying, like the redlining thing, like that is definitely a real thing and happens in so many different communities. And it's a very complex issue to solve, right? There's distrust in politics and in government. And I mean, like there's politicians who really don't care about community or about the people. They are in it for their own agenda. So there's so many different complexities. And I think this just goes back to like, yeah, you have to be a company that actually cares, be a company that's willing to put the money and invest in communities, and know that you may not get a lot of return money wise, but you're going to get a lot of return in, you know, like reward and knowing that you did something impactful in that community. And I hope that the next builders are more diverse. I hope that they take into considerations how much they'll be impacting communities that they're going to. I know here in Modesto, we're not that far away from the Bay Area. We're only about an hour and a half without traffic. And, you know, there's not the same opportunities that there is in the Bay Area that we have here. We don't have a lot of opportunities. We don't have a lot of tech jobs. There is a lack of opportunity, a lack of investment. And I can tell you a story about like going to, it was like an AMA with a local politician who was talking about what their priorities were. And one of the priorities was like infrastructure, so that commuters going to the Bay Area had better infrastructure so they could get to their jobs in the Bay Area. I was like, why is your priority that instead of creating the jobs here, like working with like companies to bring jobs to this area? And they didn't care about that. They were like, well, it's not my job to tell people where to work, you know, something like that. And I was just like, wow, you know, that's not investing in your community.
Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say this politician is an owner of a nursery and doesn't want big companies coming here with offering higher paying jobs. You know, like there is so many different reasons when you start looking into politics of why things are the way they are, you know. And this goes back to advocacy, right? Like, you have to learn how to advocate for yourself and say, like, this is not right. Like, you can't do this. Yeah, there's so much. We can probably go on and on.
No, it's true. One of the things I learned in urban planning that I would not have ever considered is everybody, yourself included, everybody needs to read their community master plans. You need to read your master plan for your city, your county. You need to read it for your transportation, for your disaster management. And you need to share these with your community. And if not everybody reads, make a video, make an audio, have a meeting, whatever it is. Make sure that people understand what's actually written in these documents. And if you align with that, then celebrate your politicians and your planners who wrote them. And if you are not in line with what is written, what the plan is of where your city is going, then you need to start to advocate to get better leaders who will evolve these plans to be more in line with the values of the community. Yeah. And not enough people read their city plans.
Yeah.
And they literally don't even know they exist.
Yeah. That stuff is lost on like websites, right? And like, you have to look for it sometimes. And that's such a great point. And you just like gave me an idea. I'm like, oh, maybe we can have an event about using technology to understand these community plans, right? Understand like what these documents are saying and where they're going.
If you want to tie it into technology, a great website is Cal EnviroScreen. Okay. And Cal EnviroScreen did a data gather and then a data visualization for that you can interact with. And so part of my big data class was to take this data, marry it to ACS data, so Census Bureau data for population, and then ask it questions. And we weren't sure we'd started with some questions that weren't that impactful. So we kept asking questions until we found that the graph moved. We were looking for something where it really showed us there was a direct correlation. And the ones that we found was that if you're white in the state of California, outside of LA, because LA is its own thing, but if you're white in the state of California, you do not have a pollution burden. If you are black or brown in the state of California, you have a pollution burden. The lines were so drastically clear that's another thing that we need to look at in cities, because a lot of people, their financial logic is, okay, this is what I can afford and it's next to a freeway. And the amount of pollutants that come off that freeway and particles impact health. And then you end up with health equity issues, because now different populations are just having different health outcomes, and also their access to healthcare and all of these things, you know, all kind of matter. So I think that's another way that you can sort of look at data, and that's where the advocacy comes in. I think we had I'd referenced crisis PR, and in crisis PR, there's a whole sort of playbook of how you do crisis PR. But a big part of it is that depending on where you're on the crisis PR playing field, I mean, sometimes if you're the subject of it as an individual, you know, there's certain things you want to say and don't say to sort of put you on the right or wrong side of the public opinion. But generally speaking, if I'm thinking more like organization, is what they'll do is instead of sort of attacking what was said or countering it, they just make their own media, they make their own stories and just put it out as sort of fresh content that says, oh, by the way, you know, we just want to let you know that this is all the good things we're doing and all the challenges, opportunities, but they don't ever name who kind of sparked that idea of why they needed to put out this announcement. But the announcement counteracts whatever was put out there first. So they don't go directly to war, but they do make sure that they put the attention on that conversation. And I think a lot of advocacy is speaking up, speaking out. Yeah. But again, not always attacking the person who did the thing that needs to be called out, but going around and finding all of your allies, finding all of your advocates, and finding people who can actually are the right ones who can make a difference. And working collectively.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I also saw that I really liked was this idea of it was a meme or a visual that I saw that resonated with me differently than how it was presented, because how it was presented was like, this is what corporate communications looks like. If you have a triangle, there's like three people talking and it's all very direct lines of communication. If you have four, now you're adding more lines and it gets more complicated. If you have 14, it looks like a fabric and it's totally interwoven. But the way I viewed that is that, oh, if you have 14, you're safe. If the people you know each other, and you have 14 people who are all working in the same direction and all want the same things and all know each other, there's enormous power in that.
Yeah.
And that's why I feel like what you're doing with GDG and creating community and creating events where people don't have to wow in how they show up. All they have to do is, the wow comes from repeated casual interactions.
Definitely. Yeah, that's interesting. That visual you're talking about, because I've worked in the corporate world, and yeah, communication when it's only at an executive level, that triangle, because that communication only stays there, everyone else feels left out. But once you start including other people, then like what Google's doing with their ambassador and organizer programs, it's like, now you're involving more people, more voices, and you're bringing more people into the conversation, making you really giving you a different approach and a more holistic approach of how to move technology forward. Right. And I think that's something that's really important, is like, you're going to learn. I definitely think Meta did not make the right move at the right time, right? If Facebook looked at their demographic of who actually uses Facebook, which I did see some of the data they had, but a large amount of people who use Facebook are Hispanic people. And I don't think and that age range was like on the older side as well. And I don't think that age range of people are going to go onto a metaverse. They're not going to go do that. And I don't know who made the decision to say like, oh yeah, let's dive deep into this metaverse, right? If they had a younger audience, that might have worked. But because there was only a certain amount of voices in the room, they were not able to protect themselves, because they didn't hear all those other, 14 voices or all those other voices that were really needed to make a holistic move and bring technology forward for everyone. They did it for a few, a smaller group. And I think that that's a very powerful message that you're talking about with that visual.
Yeah. And also someone else brought up, and I thought it was just like an interesting comment, because again, this is where I'm very siloed and I don't think of these things, is they were saying like how security questions are incredibly not thoughtful, because yeah, they'll ask like the most common security question is mother's maiden name. And a lot of people like didn't take their father's name. They may still have their mother's name, and then that's not a security question, because, well, that's my name too. Why am I using my name as my security question? And so they were just saying that like some of the questions they ask in security come from this very bubbled universe that doesn't really apply to a wider swath of society, that those would make good questions.
Yeah. I see like a lot of things when you're filling out like applications, or I'm like, where are these questions coming from? Yeah.
And things that, again, there's so much that I think in life is like, we don't see it until we see it.
Yeah.
And we can't sometimes see it until people point it out to us. And then you can't unsee it. Yeah. But you can go through life just with never having even considered that stuff until another voice comes in and says, oh, by the way. And that voice could be for opportunity, or that voice could be for things that we've always done a certain way that are kind of outdated and just need to be evolved. I think another point to this is you're now a business owner. Being a business owner is incredibly challenging, but there's opportunities and there's ways that owning your own business, you have more time freedom, you have more location freedom. You may feel like you can strike a better balance between being a professional and being a parent. And I think that in this leadership class that I just came out of, I realized I was really jaded about when they said, what are you going to do when you graduate? And I was like, I don't know. I don't see myself going back to a corporate desk. Yeah. I was living in Colorado. My mom's in California. My dad's in Pennsylvania. And I literally have a tri-city life. And that's where I was feeling really kind of jaded about the corporate world. I'm like, who's hiring me with a tri-city life? And then I was like, you know, it doesn't matter. Just be as good as I want to be at whatever I want to be good at and just trust the process.
That's awesome. Yeah. being a business owner can be very challenging, but very rewarding. You know, you get to have your own vision of what you want a company to be like. And when I co-founded it, so I have two partners, and we get to all align our vision, and you have multiple voices. So sometimes that can be challenging, but it's a good balance to have not just one person leading the way. And I truly believe, like, we rise by lifting others. Like, that was a campaign for one of the International Women's Day, and it stuck with me. And I try to do that, you know, like, I try to bring others up with me when I have opportunities. And that's how you change things, right? Like, you bring people with you. And I just want to say this, it's not easy being a founder, and there's so many challenges, especially like if you're someone who relies on, like, you know, insurance, like health insurance from a company, or if you rely on an income, right? Like, we don't all have a support system that will allow us to take time off and not make any money for a long period of time, right? Not everybody has that.
Health insurance is key. That's actually the big thing that I'm most concerned about, because I've found the one university, apparently, I mean, from the research I've done, it's the one university in the entire country, which happened to be my alumni, like where I graduated from 25 years ago, that offers health insurance to online graduate students. And many of the other schools that I looked at all said their sort of online programs are marketed through other agency like companies. And they're like, oh, no, you don't get health insurance. You're an online student. They also need to like get a running start with whatever I do, because I've been very brave about how much I'm willing to borrow to sort of get myself set on this new track. But I'm really concerned about health insurance when I graduate. I'm like, what do I do about that? And I think for a country that wants to say, oh, we support entrepreneurs, they need to revisit that. Because when I called about, they're like, oh, well, you can get individual. Well, okay, in the state of Colorado, only if I'm physically in the state of Colorado. In Pennsylvania, only if it has nothing to do with pre-existing conditions, which is literally the only reason that I interact with the medical system. So I, you know, it's like they're still not accessible.
Yeah.
So I, you know, which kind of leads me to, okay, well, I guess I need to found a company that can offer myself and its employees health insurance. But then you got to really have a running start, because that's not cheap either.
Yeah.
So, and you don't want to collapse your business as you're just starting out. So these are all realities that have to be addressed and need to be brought into the public forum, because we are a democratic society, means that we vote for our leaders. And if these issues are important to us and we're talking about them, that's why I believe these conversations do matter and have power. I will give an example of one of the best stakeholder engagements that I've seen in the research that I did. And it was actually the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey. They did 500 meetings and workshops and like with all of their stakeholders and just invited everybody in. And there were smaller level ones where they just took on a lot of feedback. There were other ones where they made presentations about where they were at and how their plans were evolving and took in a lot of feedback. And the final result was some, now they have to obviously implement it, but from a plan, it was done over 3 years, and it really was an exercise in listening and collaborating. And a really good example of like, what does a really good and committed stakeholder engagement look like to really understand what's needed and wanted by the community?
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think there, that doesn't happen in a lot of places, right? Like the community is not involved for different reasons, like trust, access, and really like time, right? Like sometimes people don't have the time because they're working and they have families and they have parents to take care of, or, you know, like there's so many different reasons why. So it, again, like like local leaders have to care enough to give people opportunities to go. Like if you want mothers to be there, you should provide childcare. You know, if even fathers, like you need to provide childcare. If you want more people, more diversity, you need to really be thoughtful about how you're going to lead these plans. And that doesn't happen everywhere. So that's really amazing. Yeah.
We did a lot of those exercises in our school, and it was, if you're going to have a meeting and these people are coming from work, yeah, make sure there's food. Yes. You know, they don't need to be starved through this process, and make sure there's childcare, make sure there's language resources, because mm-hmm. not, you know, so you're creating diversity, accessibility, and really understanding, you know, who are the people who are in this meeting, and what are their needs to be effective at being able to actually hear what they have to say. And that it shouldn't just be, you know, because a lot of times we get this impression of the community meetings just are people shouting at each other or just one person talking to the stage and just shutting everybody else down. But like, how can we inform each other? Because someone has an opinion, they don't have all the facts. And then this person can say, well, okay, I hear you, but can you fill in a couple of these other realities into your thinking? And then, you know, you can evolve your thinking and come back and be like, okay, I thought about that, but there's still these considerations that I need you to take into consideration. And so that each part of this stakeholder engagement is informing and educating and evolving the process on the other side.
Yeah, I think a good way for that is to have a facilitator who knows how to de-escalate like situations, and really knows how to organize an event to make sure that everyone gets the best out of, you know, what the goal is for the event, right? If the goal is to come up with a plan, like let's utilize the time that we're there for getting to that, right? And saying at the beginning, like if there's something that is not relevant to what we're trying to get for this event, like we'll talk about it later. Let's, you know, table that talk for something else, and just make sure to set those expectations, right? Like, And that's hard to do. Not everybody has a facilitator who can do something like that. So even it's so weird, like just something as simple as having a really good facilitator can lead to meetings like not going, you know, like that screaming, like everyone's just shouting, or just one person like shutting everyone down. Like, yeah, it's there's like simple things that you can put in place to help run a community better, run a meeting better.
Well, I think it a lot of it comes from that you're not alone on your side, back to that sort of that fabric, that 14, if you're not the only voice, but you're coming with power, and you're coming with coordination, and you're coming with community action, and that, you know, that the goal is aligned of what is being sought. And I feel like from what we were talking about before, the work that you're doing as an ambassador, the work that you're doing in your community, the work that you're doing in mentoring and advancing tech, all of those goals seem incredibly aligned and incredibly important now, because we as society, I would say that everybody, doesn't matter who you are, the last 20 years has had to become digitally literate. Mm-hmm. And now we're at a place where everybody needs to become data literate, as Web3 and everything is evolving. And I think that you are just doing incredibly important work in making sure that those divides don't continue to grow, and making sure that you're pulling people along to be part of this revolution. And it is a revolution, and it's changing our society. I remember just, again, in small ways, mm-hmm. When I moved to Colorado, social media was brand new to Colorado in 2012. It was well established between 2007, 2010 on the coast, but in the middle of the country, it was just getting into corporate, into business, and executives were like, what do we do with this? We're supposed to have a Facebook page. What's LinkedIn? And so I had just come from Los Angeles and I was well employed in helping companies find their digital presence. But the problem was you got a lot of middle-aged women who were very set in their career. They'd worked hard to get to the positions that they were in, and they were mostly boomers, and they were absolutely petrified of this new technology, and they were mad about it. They were mad that it had infiltrated their office, that they were supposed to have both a person, like they got onto Facebook personally, but now they were supposed to like do it for work as well. Mm-hmm. And they had very private personal lives and very sort of separated business identities and had no idea what to do with any of this. And it just spoke to this fear of being left behind if they didn't like get with the program. And but there was lots of fears around it. There was a fear, like if I get on LinkedIn, my boss will think I'm looking for a new job and he'll fire me. And then the same boss didn't know enough about LinkedIn and probably would. Yeah. So it was very much new territory. And I think it is really important to, like a lot of them gained a lot more confidence because people offered classes and people offered talks and were like, let's talk about it. Let's bring you along. Let's not have you live in panic or fear about this. You know, let's find strategies that work for you. And so it's necessary to make sure that these, either they don't know that they don't know, or they have an idea of something that just strikes fear in their heart, to bring them along and not have them be left behind.
That's such a true thing. I was talking to, he was a director for a large corporation, and he was like, yeah, I can't keep up with everything. It's so hard. Like there's so much coming out, like Internet of Things, AI, blockchain. He's like, how do I keep up? So even, you know, like even a lot of leaders are having this issue of like this fear of like being left out because they don't know enough about it. And he was like, is there like, I would like to see something on just a general understanding of like how all these technologies work in a way that like, I know if somebody's talking to me, they're not BSing me, you know? And it's like, yeah, that's probably important. And I was telling him like for our Dev Fest, like we wanted to have a business leadership track. And we were thinking about it more in a way of like how business leaders can help underserved communities or how business leaders can help the community that we're in. Right. But we never thought about it like how we can help business leaders understand technology. So I was like, that's another lens that somebody brings, you know? So there's so many people with the fear of being left out of technology. And then there's people who don't even realize like they will be left out. Right. And those, it's hard. So the work that we're doing here in Modesto and so many other women tech makers and GDG organizers are doing is definitely needed in all these communities. So I appreciate you and all the women tech maker ambassadors that helped me like get through some difficult times in my journey. And I really appreciate you having me here.
Oh, this has been great. So any final words that you have, encouragement, inspiration?
Just keep going. Don't stop. And it's okay to be scared. Do it anyways.
And that wraps up another episode of Muse and Metrics here on 360 Talk Radio for Women. I hope today's conversation sparked new ideas and offered insights that resonate with you. Before we sign off, a special mention to our sponsor, HypeHer, an exciting new marketing platform focused on women supporting women. HypeHer is launching soon, and it's all about empowering and amplifying women's voices, projects, and companies. Be sure to check them out and join a community of inspiring women driving change at hypeher.io. That's HYPEHER.io, and join their beta. I'd also love to keep the conversation going with you. Visit our website, museandmetrics.com, for more information about our show and the guests we feature. Your thoughts and feedback make our community stronger, so don't hesitate to reach out. And don't forget to follow Muse and Metrics on YouTube, Medium, Instagram, and LinkedIn for the latest updates. We have a fantastic lineup of topics and guests coming up, including new content related to International Women's Day and the Women Tech Makers theme for 2024, Impact the Future. Thank you for tuning in. And remember, every week we're here to bring you new perspectives at the intersection of technology, career, and change. Until next time, keep challenging norms, asking questions, and seeking answers. This is Philippa Burgess signing off. Stay curious and stay connected.